Hello and welcome to One Game at a Time, where this week we look at cash. Cash money in the form of pounds, shillings and pence, as we track the development of the rules and the strategies that make our game the one that we know and love. And it's good evening this evening to Finn. Finn O'Sullivan, how are you doing?
G'day, gentlemen. I'm really looking forward to, discussing what it means to the amateur. That's focusing not only on the VFL, but also moving 20,000K away to our rugby origins, which we discussed in episode one, Ryan Miller.
Evening, gents. How are we?
Oh, well, I'm very well.
I'm excited tonight to talk about some money. Not just in terms of AFL and sport. I don't know. Have we got any sponsors yet? Are we getting any sponsors out there? We are more than happy to shamelessly
move from the amateur to
triple,
the professional.
I'll tell you, Triple M has got nothing on me. I can promote whatever you like. Okay, so whatever comes up, we're happy to do it. More than happy.
You're happy to drive for Shell and Putt for Dough.
Oh my god, that is actually, I doffed my hat on that one. That was pretty spectacular. I thought you left the goal. Yeah, I'm like, yo, this episode is
how long can we keep this
up
running for? That's all I know. Yeah.
It was like,
look,
forever.
I think it's got legs, but this episode is all about money and how money, sadly, or however you see it, it shapes our existence, and it shapes the existence of this game that we know and love. Reading recently from the AFL website, Mr. Miller, it seems that there's not only those tall forwards who callously change from their homes and move across. We reference Buddy Franklin, who tries his very best to run too far, and Tom Boyd, who leave for multi-million dollar contracts, a million a year. But there's the quality players who are there year in, year out, are also getting paid. Who are the other four?
So six millionaires, quoted earlier in the year. So Gary Ablett Jr., obviously.
Nat Fyfe.
That's been around for a bit. Yeah. There's a fairly large contract. Nat Fyfe, Scott Pendlebury, and Nick Nat at West Coast is the other one.
Yeah.
And there's a few others. But the money hasn't always gone in the direction, I suppose, it does now, in terms of players getting the... I suppose you could say money they deserve. Is that the right way to say it? I would say so.
Certainly, if you look at Nick Nat and players like that, everyone wants to be him. Yeah. Basically, he's the most exciting footballer.
Certainly not on this year's performance.
Well, of course not. But when he's playing and playing well,
yeah,
he is the guy who's the most exciting player in WA. Sorry to Nathan Fyfe if you're listening, but that Brownlow stands for nothing in the eyes of a 9-year-old child who watches Nick Natanui rise above
true.
A pack.
It's very true.
And really, that's what spurs us today. Who's been in
guess
contact?
Guess who's back? Yeah. This guy's he's going to need his own jingle, this fella. Kieran from Watsonia. Whenever I just straight on, Kieran's, I suppose, Twitter handle. Sorry, that's what I was looking for. So Kieran from Watsonia, once again, why is Liam giving people from Bendigo so much grief? He said they were lovely from Bendigo. I totally agree with him. I don't know why he's doing it. We could cut to this scene now where Liam is shouting at the top of his lungs.
Back to Bendigo next week, mate, if you're going to bounce it like that.
Kieran, I can only apologise, really, for his actions. me and Finn need to keep a tighter sort of leash at this point. I don't really know what else we can do.
Look, I'd like to defend myself. I just was trying to indicate that 150 kilometres is a long way away to be sent for a shit-ass bounce.
You could have picked any direction on the compass, though, mate. North, south, Ballarat's fine. Like, no, you
we're
went straight
across the Alpines back there.
I see why it's appealed to Kieran from Watsonia's roots as a historian of the gold rush and all that. He obviously feels strong ties. And, hey, Kieran, thanks for writing in, and I'll expect that Ryan Crowley tag to continue.
I don't think he's going anywhere.
That's the Fremantle tag, not the Essendon tag.
Yeah, that's it. I don't think he's not going anywhere. Don't worry about that.
In an academic sense, David Magris from Sunbury, Finn, has come to us with something that's truly interesting.
And it's interesting, in fact, that it's quite similar to our Australian game, which many of our listeners won't know. He asked the the a brief history of American footy. And it kind of did start the same way as our footy did, with, I guess, people meeting, or in their cases, schools meeting and developing their own game. So I guess it's kind of credited in 1874, the first American footy match between McGill University of Montreal, actually, in Canada, and Harvard University. And they actually did something that Carlton did when they travelled up to New South Wales when they played Waratah in 1877. They played one half their rules, the other half the other rules. So they played the Montreal, who was playing the rugby rules, and Harvard were playing this Boston style, which was similar.
Mm-hmm.
And we fast forward a little bit, and suddenly Harvard are bringing along Princeton, Columbia, and Yale to a meeting in Springfield in 1876, and hello to all those fans that we have in Springfield. And they do agree to play the 1871 rugby rules. And look, this lasts for a little bit, but basically this bloke called Walter Camp comes along and changes everything. And if we could put that in perspective, he's kind of like he's the Tom Wills.
Yeah.
So they've taken the rules directly from the English set of rules,
rules. They haven't done anything yet.
And transplanted them straight into the middle of America.
Camp was such a fan of this running style of play, but he found rugby rules too chaotic. And he didn't like the notion that there were only two ways to gain ground in rugby, basically either running the ball forward or kicking it forward. And you'd like this, Mr. Miller, he felt a higher level of organisation was possible with more intricately worked plays and tactics. What he did was, and this is amazing, will love this, he proposed the end of the scrum, which was agreed to by the other colleges of the time, Princeton, Columbia, and Yale. Teams soon discovered that they could just simply hold on to the ball for the entire half, as there was no more free-flowing play due to the abolition of the scrum. And eventually, this is where the downs come from. They were introduced in the early 1880s, which led to the creation of the gridiron, which is at the core of this question. And they're the stripes on the American footy field.
Yeah,
that's where the grids come from. So this removal of the scrum and the passing game led to players protecting the ball carry in front of the line. So I think what they're called blockers, in the States. And insane injuries were occurring. And these injuries also resulted in deaths and continued to do so.
Because those men just wear impact.
That's their job, to protect the ball carry. And again, if we move back to 1859, pioneers of our game, that's what they wanted to avoid.
Yeah, exactly.
Running into each other.
Yeah.
And it took, again, Theodore Roosevelt, the President of the United States in 1905, he threatened to ban the game, just like
the
monarchs centuries beforehand in England. And this basically led to the Ford Pass. So you no longer had this occurring.
Yeah.
And it's again one of those things where people read the rules.
Yeah, tactics.
They take it to its absolute outer stretch.
Yeah, that's
where
right. What can we get away with?
Any ordinary man would go, well, that's not on, is it?
Yeah, don't do that.
And and they say, well, look, it doesn't say anything.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm going to stand here with the ball.
And just lie on the ground.
And continually get tackled.
Yeah.
Until there's a strategy against it, or a rule that intervenes to change what happens.
Absolutely. And to summarise, I mean,
to combat it, the pass goes forward, whereas in a different kind of existence, a kick could have gone back or sideways or whatever, and it combats it. And
I just love this stuff, and just the fact that there was one guy at one of the colleges who decided, okay, I'm going to lie on the ball, or a coach came up to her, or another player, or they collectively came up with this idea. If that hadn't have happened, well, what does the game look like then? Well,
absolutely. Just like what you were talking about a few episodes before, the Italians versus...
England, which was, less than a year ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I guess to summarise, as the Australian and the American game, even though they were decades apart, and maybe for some listeners it might be difficult to believe, but the Australian game was well before the American game.
Yeah.
They both moved away from the English schoolboy origins.
Mm.
And it was this it was a profound movement that hopefully we can move into, I guess, the professional aspect of it.
We're talking about a climate in Melbourne that has been an incredibly successful Victorian colony, but has just had a bubble burst in terms of real estate. And we're going to come to an economics report in just a minute. East Melbourne is a very busy suburb. Just to the east of the CBD, we wind up with Captain Lonsdale's cow paddock housing three effective arenas. They're not arenas in the sense that we know them now. They perhaps house about 10,000 at capacity at East Melbourne and at Punt Road. And the MCG might have a little bit more over time. But they're all within the one area. During this episode, I'm going to talk about East Melbourne a little bit. The East Melbourne Cricket Ground doesn't exist anymore. But if you were standing at where the bridge is just before Jolimont Station, or what is now Jolimont Road that runs on the west side of the MCG, that you would be looking over East Melbourne Cricket Ground towards Federation Square, down to Flinders Street. And that's where a lot of the action happens for the VFA and then the VFL. And that really takes until 1920 when it's compulsorily acquired for the railway, the yards to be extended from Flinders Street, and the advent of the Hurstbridge line and the opportunity for some Collingwood fans to get on the train. which is very just still exciting. All the way out to Victoria Park there. But so all that exists, and then just to the north of that, you've got Scotch, and that, you know, Scotch doesn't move away from there until a long time later. They're the people who create the East Melbourne Cricket Ground, and then St Pat's just above that. You've got the Fitzroy Gardens, the Victorian Brewing Company that makes our famous VB. It's a busy, busy place. And anywhere else above where VB is there, the Catholics own it. And it's a busy happening area.
It's interesting when we talked about the, I suppose, original development of the rules and the original origins of the sport, what was going on in Melbourne, it's thriving, gold rush, all these kind of things. Well, things change quite quickly, and when we start looking at around the time where the VFL was developed, as we talked about in last episode, there's some problems starting to emerge, I suppose, economically. There's strikes, maritime, Australian Shearers strike, and then in like 1891 we get, you know, a number of, it's like 16 banks close, Broken Hill goes on strike, and then it keeps going for 1892 you get 133 limited companies going to liquidation in Victoria, and then the depression hits and we've got a problem.
It's worth noting there for all of those people who have been following the real estate boom of Melbourne in the last 20 or 30 years, read your history books, because in the 1890s, property was way overvalued and businesses were incredibly overvalued by investors. And when that popped, exactly what you talk about, banks, businesses, and all of those started to collapse. Of course, we're more structured now around that and too big to fail, of course. But and at the time, that overvaluation and the excitement around being the biggest colony fell in a big heap.
Now no longer the biggest colony, because in 1890 New South Wales overtook us population, and also at the same time this would have contributed to it that gold was discovered in WA. So people were leaving. So, you know, houses were overvalued, banks were falling apart, people had no jobs. So let's pack up our bags and move to WA.
Yeah, look, I think we are sort of trying to paint a whole picture here for our lovely listeners about what was going on, because obviously we're going to talk about the movement from an amateur status within a sport into a professional status in 1912, but what was going on in that time? Like, why did the you know, this need for professionalism need to occur? you know, what are some of the things that are going on in the local community? Why are people looking at their recreation in a in a different way? You know,
because there's a decade of, or at least the decade of decreed amateur status, isn't there, Finn, in the VFL?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we're not suggesting the players weren't paid. They certainly were, even though it was illegal to be paid. And look, they were paid through a variety of ways. Rent, jewellery.
A job.
Absolutely. And some actually were promised like an end of season footy trip, not like to Bali or anything like that, but it would have been maybe out to Bendigo.
That'd be lovely.
It's a beautiful,
And fine people out there.
Yeah,
for us, this Bendigo. And remember, I mean, we're trying to paint this picture.
Everyone's painting pictures.
We're painting a lot of pictures, but
there's no tapestries,
we're painting tapestries. It should be noted that, look, tracing all this stuff back, all the cash transactions, obviously, this would have been impossible to enforce because if we remember at the time, income tax in Victoria did not exist.
Well, so you earn a check and that's what you took out?
That was it.
Sounds
so funny. There's no organisation, there's no ATO knocking down the door of these clubs. So, and that's a factor.
Yeah,
and it's not my way to appeal to Liberal voters in any way, but through all of these economic disasters of the 1890s, the Labor Party take a firm hold, and so do unions at the time, and that's really where taxation begins to come into the 1900s.
Well, if we pull the union, the VFLUA, the Victorian Football League Umpire Association, started in 1909 at this time, and that was their big thing of remuneration and safety. And just going back on to the promise of an end-of-season footy trip, Jeffrey Blaney in A Game of Our Own, thank you, Jeffrey, hopefully you're listening.
On you, Jeff.
Cites during the 1893 season, Port Melbourne players went on strike as they were promised an end-of-season trip to Bendigo.
Oh.
But this was retracted because the club's officials cited a lack of funds and
couldn't get them up there.
Couldn't get them up to Bendigo.
That's devastating.
And there'll be listeners out there, I'm not saying for Marcelin or anything like that.
You be careful here.
Who have put their $100 down at the start of the season, hoping to go on a trip.
Yeah, that's
and all of a sudden it's no not trip. There and suddenly your trip to Hobart's gone.
All the fines throughout the year, everything that went on throughout the club, no trip, footy trip was cutting. Yeah.
So this is kind of where these were the payments. Yeah, these were the payments of the time.
So why do we move into a professional area? What changed things?
Well, it seems that the professionalism was demanded by those clubs that broke away to make the VFL. They demanded the fixture.
Yep.
They wanted the guaranteed places to play.
Yep.
They wanted a seat at the table of governance and decision making. And they wanted to be sure that what they were doing was what the sport was going to become. Because they'd seen a draft form in the VFA and they didn't want that. They wanted to make it theirs and their own. At the same time, the VFA are still trying to innovate and do things, but the VFL really become the dominant in terms of wealth, in terms of direction, and in terms of development planning for the whole place. So you wind up with the furthest you have to go really to play footy is all the way out to Royal Park or to Carlton to play. And the VFL are very well aware of this. Even by 1908, they realise that it's university and Richmond, effectively still very city places, that they expand the league to. And that's the dominant force. The more central you are, the more money you're going to make, the more interest.
There seems like there's money in the sport as well. Like it's almost stability. It seems to be a massive factor in this. You know, we can see gate figures going back. You know, before, you know, talking 1880s, you know, there's gates of 35,000 plus, in certain games, which means, there's gate figures around it. I think we found one, I think it was $747 £747 for South Melbourne Geelong game, which We had a go at trying to work that out. We reckon it's about
100,000.
Yeah. So there's some money in the act in the sport, but it, I think this kind of centralizing or centralization of the funds might be a big thing around even things like player contracts. Like, I don't want to lose so and so next year. How are we going to hold on to them? Well, we make them sign a bit of paper that's going to make them stay. That seems like a massive driving force.
And even if you sign up, it doesn't matter that much. Like, ask Gary Ablett Jr. at the moment whether that last year in his contract really matters.
Well, yeah, and players are going to want this. Like, if you're a player who, because of the climate at that particular time, you're not sure where your next meal's coming from for the family, you're struggling for a bit of cash, are you going to spend your Saturday playing footy, or are you going to spend your Saturday working, earning money? Or you go, well, if I get this contract, or if I can make sure that I can play for this amount of time, I'm going to get paid this sum of money. Seems like a really
logical thing.
It's the
same right now. And we talked about it last episode. It's free agency. If we're giving these players the opportunity, then they're going to select the best opportunity for them and their family, not because they have any allegiance to any club or anything like that. And I think, last episode, Liam, you said, let's be mindful of people that say these days or in my day. Having allegiance to a club, it's not that it didn't exist, but it's not what people... Not what people think it was. Not at all.
And it's half the reason for the whole podcast that people have this view that at some other generation it was perfect, or it was correct, or it was wrong even. There's this sense that at some other stage it was so different. The same problems have been cropping up for the same amount of time.
Gambling, last one.
Well, exactly. And as you relax a certain form of regulation, another problem comes in. So our government's relaxed regulation around gambling 20 years ago, and it's an enormous problem now. People making a podcast in 40 years' time may well look back at it and be challenging people who are saying similar things or forgetting similar things about history. If we go to those admissions... The MCC eventually allowed Melbourne and Carlton to play a game in 1877 in June, and they charged sixpence, an extra sixpence to sit in the grandstand.
Ooh, reserve.
Reserve seating, effectively. People are turning up, 8,000 to 10,000 people are turning up at the MCG. The East Melbourne Cricket Ground get... wind of this, and they decide, well, gee whiz, if we can get sixpence for this, all of a sudden we can begin to build money. And of course it's all about building funds and wealth for the cricket club, but the popularity is truly in the winter form of the game, which is where people are happy to shell out this silver coin donation, and that's really, really profitable for smaller clubs around the place. And of course, that begins to move to Royal Park, Punt Road, and so on, and grandstands get built, and you know it's a true sort of development or game of civilization sort of building over decades and decades.
Yeah, and look, it's no surprise that this professionalism was happening before your 1912, where it was starting to be legal to be paid, because the VFL began paying its field umpires 30 shillings and boundary umpires 7 shillings in 1905. And this was 4 years before the union even came to be about. So there is this essence of, if we want this game to move forward, we need to start, we need to start knuckling down and start paying people, because why would they continue?
That seems like the number one reason across sports for for making a game professional, the control of money, and the fact that people needed to pay players in order to for a particular reason. So rugby's a great example. Rugby didn't turn professional until 1995,
Rugby union.
I beg your pardon.
That's because they're all doctors and lawyers anyway.
Not in Wales so much.
Like, you don't have to pay the king to play rugby. Like, he's it right. Is, he knows where he's thinking he was coming from.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. I think.
And all our listeners in England, we've got 12 of them.
Yeah,
we have 12.
No, they are mainly thank my family. Listening. I think. Yeah. Thanks, mum. So the biggest thing is in the north of England where rugby league came about, rugby league became professional around a similar time to when AFL did. They were paying people anyway as rugby union players because they needed to get them to and from games. They there was different things going on in the north than there was in the south. So they had to develop a professional activity. They decided, well, we've got to, like, otherwise how are we going to look after, these people that, they're devoting their time to us.
Keep our players to...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Can control their club, all those kind of things. So they were paying people, and eventually rugby league became professional a long, long time before rugby union did. A long time.
And I guess it pushes us back to what we were reading or what's in the news currently is, bad as it is, why not have pokies? North Melbourne is currently the only club not to have them. And what we're talking about here is money and keeping players and making the sport more professional.
The dilemma becomes a moral one where you're meant to be a community champion, but in fact...
But that's what they argue as well. We give back to the community. That's what they say.
The dilemma becomes that you take away from the community by providing something that provides the money to create the players to, in fact, guarantee that we need to pay them more, and it becomes a self-sustaining disaster for the community.
So really, basically, in 120 years, haven't come that far.
No, and that's the very nature of capitalism, I suppose, in once business and money meet, it's going to be the case that you spend too much on big players, if you look at soccer and what they do there, there's no way that makes money. The only way that they can do it is to be bankrolled by,
Sheikh Mohammed.
Sheikh Mohammed from the Middle East.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Australian rules footy clubs largely are sustained by sponsorship and members by really serious board members, guys like Eddie Maguire, who doesn't get paid big money from the Collingwood Footy Club, but really puts big work in out of his heart.
He doesn't get paid barely anything, does he?
I don't think so.
No.
But
I think, North Melbourne, from amateur to whatever level of professionalism you want to talk about, this is a continuum, however you want to look at it, however clubs want to deal with it, however players do. North Melbourne have obviously taken a stance, which I applaud, really, in terms of the fact they're not going to be bankrolled by pokies. But you look at, some sports who have decided that they do not want to be professional at all.
Not in sports. Clubs. This has occurred. Occurred 120 years ago. So Melbourne chose not to pay its players from 1903 to 1913. Now, obviously, up until 1912, it was illegal to pay, but everyone knew that people were getting paid. And, it's not surprising that they weren't in the top four for those years.
I think morality, it's interesting, I think, the way people paint it, the idea of not being paid for something, the morality that goes with that, like amateur spirit, I think people describe it as sometimes, like this idea that traditions of fair play, respect for opponents.
Gentlemen.
English when we're talking about, I suppose some of the English sports that we talked about. But that, I just think that whole idea of like an amateur sport of respect for opponents, match officials, the way the league is maintained, rules, all those kind of things, the way they conduct themselves, that somehow money will taint that or affect it in some other way. It's a nice thing to say. I'm not sure how accurate it really is, but I think we talk about, okay, a sport moves from being amateur to professional as if it's like this line in the sand moment. Okay, now we're a professional outfit, this is what we're going to do. Let's get the new dietitian in and You're all getting paid $1 million. It's never like that. The VFL developed its professionalism over 20 years. It's been paying guys for a long time before 1912.
And before the VFL as well.
Yeah, in the VFL. Like, yeah, exactly right. Brown envelopes slipped under.
Yep.
Under doors, I suppose. Is that the way they did it?
Yeah, and that... If we return to North Melbourne, North Melbourne failed twice during their time in the VFA before they were introduced in 1925. At a board level. They were, for a start, not rated because of the aggressive nature of Arden Street and their supporters, but equally, the way that they were managed... You know, from a business sense, wasn't endorsed by the VFL. Therefore, they had to disband.
You're not a professional outlet, so no, you're not ready to come in.
Yes,
it happened during their time in the VFA, and then in their time when they were trying to enter the VFL, they disbanded, came back together again because they were told you guys can't come back again as a board. They came back in, and then eventually were able to enter the VFL. In 1925, but it took that long. You know, they should have been there
in 1897,
and certainly should have been there in 1908. But it's tragic. But Putt for Dough, as you know about Mr. Miller, is part and parcel of business existence, and that transfers to sport. And the tragedy of it is that we're dominated by the very few. In terms of players, we're not the back pocket who humbly goes about their business is not the player who's remembered. You know, it's Albert Thurgood at the turn of the century who is the dominant player for the Bombers, who in fact goes to WA Finn to make money and returns again, and he's the most sought player at the time because of how exciting he is.
Absolutely, and basically Essendon can. I mean, you can't put the premierships down to a single person, but he was such a dominating figure that...
He's a marketing figure as well, much like Fife and Nat Nui and that are. Just having him draws the crowd.
Absolutely, and drew premierships.
Mm.
And he left in 1894 to try his luck in the West, just like many Aussies going up there to the gold rush. And he didn't come back until 1899, and Essendon were not the same without him. And just as a side note, this bloke could kick 102 yards old. That's about 90 meters. And I think I recall a match. I think St Kilda player from the centre square.
Jeff Fearing.
I think it's him.
He kicks it at Moorabbin.
Torpedo at Moorabbin. Yeah. That it comes close.
If you want good viewing, a rugby union video of Wales versus Scotland, Mr. Miller. We might post it on our Twitter and Facebook with the guy's name.
So Paul Thorburn was the guy. It was 70 metres over the cross, 10 foot. Remember the rugby union, the bar is 10 feet in the air. Yeah. So it doesn't just have to go through the sticks.
It's about an 80 metre place kick.
So his place kick off the ground. So he Malcolm just ran White up and life, so he just ran up. It's like 1980, 1981. Mm. If you look at Paul Thorburn, it's the first thing that comes up because the only thing he did was rubbish. unlike Michael Blight, who could do a few other things. Yes. Paul Thorburn could belt it a long way, but he couldn't do bloody anything else.
The game itself is a beautiful game by this stage. It, as we will come to in future episodes, begins to develop the high mark. The drop kick is now a beautiful thing. The chosen way to have a shot for goal becomes the place kick for a little while. And a system of finals develops that's more exciting for the fan. The media become really serious in creating a game that is much more like what we're talking about.
Mm.
And as the handball begins to be brought into the game, they're all things that we're going to investigate very soon. Victoria as a league, though, is different to the South Australian game.
Yeah.
It's also different to the Western Australian game. Mm. And they begin to play off. And it also becomes the case that there's this suggestion that it's almost like the European league in soccer, that the winners of the league, so yeah, you know, Essendon play Port Adelaide, yeah, and that's the exciting bit, and that's the footy trip,
yeah,
you know, and that's the exciting thing. So they don't miss out. So look, thanks Finn for the evening, and thanks for all of your research.
Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Thank you to Ryan.
Thanks guys, brilliant work.
And with all the money that's gone around this evening, I'd like to say that these guys are terrific value, and we value every single one of you out there. Hit us up at Origins of Footy on the Twitter, hit us at One Game at a Time on Facebook, and you can also email us. But we'd also like to say, as we do each week, please don't get ahead of yourselves and take it one game at a time.